Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is January the 1st, 2020. Happy New Year and season's greeting to one and all. A shout out to all the military men and women serving our country and is away from home at this time of the year. We thank you for your services. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. We will be kicking off the show with a news roundup of 2019, the biggest tech stories of the year. And we have feature segments from Mark Liosa, On the Mark, Battery Care According to the Battery University. From Benjamin Rockwell, IT Pro Series, and he will present Windows 7 End of Life, Part 1. Part 2 will be next week. I'll have a segment on, are multiple core processors always better? I'll try to answer that. And for Marty Winston, All Hands on Tech, upcoming 2020 CES in Las Vegas, and retrofitting a 40-year house to be energy efficient. Looking back at 2019, what an absolute roller coaster it has been for Huawei. The Chinese telecommunications company was constantly in the news involving bad press or controversy. It made for some of the biggest headline news of the past year. While the controversies associated with the company goes back a fair way, things really started heating up towards the end of last year when Huawei CFO and daughter of founder was arrested in Canada, facing extradition to the United States following a rather unhealthy bout of rhetoric back and forth between Huawei and the United States over national security concerns, eventually culminating in the now infamous Huawei ban when the company was placed on the U.S. entity list. Placing Huawei on the entity list essentially meant that they were banned from using American technologies without permission from the government. The administration said the bans were instituted due to serious national security concerns that Huawei equipment could be used for spying, a claim that the company has always strongly denied. A range of other Chinese companies felt the brunt of the bans as well, as the list grew throughout the year. One of the biggest blows for Huawei was related to its dealings with Google, which was no longer able to supply Huawei with a priority version of Android or Google applications, which are staples of Huawei's smartphone products. While the company was granted a couple of extensions on this, ultimately they were forced to submit to the pressure, releasing their first smartphone without Google apps in September, which runs an open source version of Android. This has led to Huawei ramping up the production of an in-house operating system called Harmony OS. Although they have said this is a better fit for the Internet of Things devices, such as televisions, rather than for powering for smartphones. Crucially, this has all been occurring amid a still-going trade dispute between China and the United States, with Huawei serving as a key player in these tensions. As part of this, the United States has been pressuring allies to also shelve dealings with Huawei with varying effects. Many of the company's key relationships, even beyond those from the United States. Of course, the saga is still ongoing, and it'll be interesting what happens in 2020. At issue is not what Huawei is putting into the product, the fact that they are into many consumer products, and the firmware built in it may have no malware at all, but if patches are required, there's no monitoring that those patches would not include a backdoor for spying by the Chinese government. The Chinese government has maintained that there's no connection between they, the government, and Huawei, the company. But yet, in negotiations, they're tied in pretty tightly. Facebook's big Libra announcement. After suffering one of tech's biggest scandals through the Cambridge Analytica disaster last year, Facebook's reputation was tarnished at the start of 2019. Cambridge Analytica opened users' eyes around the world to what can go wrong when a company misuses personal data, so it probably wasn't the greatest timing for Facebook to start taking control of financial data, but that's exactly what they did with Libra. Initially backed by a cohort of payment giants and tech darlings, including Visa, MasterCard, Spotify, and Uber, Libra is blockchain-powered and cryptocurrency aimed at providing payment abilities to the billions of people around the world without access to a bank account. Largely, though, it is a play to make digital crypto payments more mainstream and standardized, as its status as a stable coin makes it less volatile. Of course, it didn't take long for regulators around the world to raise their eyebrows. Concerns were raised over how Facebook would handle user data, as well as whether the coin could be used for malicious purposes. Facebook assured that it wouldn't actually rule Libra with an iron fist, leaving management and regulation to the independent Libra Foundation made up of the aforementioned backers and a slew of others. That idea did not bode well later in the year, though, as it was announced that a bunch of them, including most of the payment giants, would be pulling out. At this point, it's not clear whether Libra will even go ahead in 2020, although Facebook has insisted that it is still full steam ahead. As they said, you can trust Facebook with your data. Yeah, sure. Oh, speaking of Cambridge Analytica, Facebook also received a massive, although some would say insignificant, $5 billion fine from the Federal Trade Commission over the incident. The fine was a culmination of a years-long investigation into the Cambridge Analytica scandal, as well as other privacy breaches. Along with the fine, the company was tasked with conducting a privacy review of every new product and service, with reviews submitted to the CEO and a third-party assessor every quarter. Do you trust Facebook with your personal data? The past year in cybersecurity. Rather, I should say, the past year in security. The realm of cybersecurity is undoubtedly one of the most exciting, while at the same time worrisome, in areas of technology. While it seems like security researchers are constantly making ground against some of the most sophisticated attacks, it seems they are all too often outmatched by their black hat counterparts. And there has been some most significant trends in the past year. Data breaches with Capital One and Facebook are the big offenders. It would be hard to argue that the massive Capital One data breach, which impacted 100 million U.S. customers and the further 6 million from Canada, wasn't the most eye-catching data breach of the year. It's not an award that you want to win, by the way. As one of the biggest data breaches ever, hackers swiped swaths of crucial personal information of customers, including 140,000 social security numbers, 80,000 bank account numbers, and 1 million insurance numbers of Canadian customers, as well as credit scores and limits, payment history, balances, and contact information. This isn't even including your garden variety type of data that usually gets swiped, including names and addresses, zip and postal codes, phone numbers, email addresses, and dates of birth. Facebook was also a major offender when it came to breaches this year overall, although not many led to real damage. Perhaps one of the more concerning occurred in September, when around 30 million people had phone numbers and personal data exposed in cyber attack, which saw the FBI open an investigation. In conjunction to that, though, April saw security researchers find more than 540 million user records sitting on unprotected cloud computing servers. A month before that, the company also left hundreds of millions of passwords sitting in plain text on internal servers, and while later in the year, the company admitted that dozens of third-party apps may have had access to user data for months. By the way, this is all Facebook, and they're telling us we can trust them. The Marriott security breach is also one worth mentioning, as it broke records in January with hackers accessing records from up to 383 million guests, including 5 million passport numbers. Then we have bugs in WhatsApp, Apple FaceTime, and Zoom used for spying. While there was certainly no shortage of major data breaches, there were also some pretty concerning bugs spotted out in the wild. In May, a vulnerability was spotted with Facebook-owned encrypted messaging service WhatsApp that would allow malicious actors to remotely inject Israeli spyware on the user's device by simply calling it. Described as one of the worst security bugs seen, it allowed attackers to inject the malware developed by NSO Group without the target even needing to answer the phone. Another bug that made headlines was related to Apple's FaceTime application. It allowed you to call anyone with FaceTime and immediately hear audio coming from the other person's phone without that person having accepted or rejected the incoming call. The feature, of course, went viral before Apple issued an iOS patch to plug it. Similarly, a vulnerability with video conferencing platform Zoom was also discovered, which allowed attackers to hijack webcams. And luckily, though, this time around, the flaw was discovered by a security researcher rather than hackers, meaning Zoom was able to issue a patch quick smart. The flaw was still significant, though, as in conjunction with letting attackers peer at you and into your home, and the flaw could also have been used to launch a distributed denial of service attack. And, of course, the big news was ransomware causing havoc to public offices. Ransomware may be 30 years old, but it seemed like you couldn't go a week in 2019 without hearing about an attack causing some distress to an organization. In fact, there is notable upwards trend of ransomware laying off targeting consumers and increasing targeting businesses. Some of the most notable attacks hit U.S. public offices, with ransomware hitting Florida City, Louisiana, New Orleans, Texas, and Baltimore. This marks an alarming trend of ransomware targeting the public infrastructure, noting their necessity for uptime. And finally, FaceApp, not what it seems. With mobile apps that do something as innocent and, frankly, impressive as aging a photo of its users, you'd be forgiven to thinking it's all above board. However, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, that's the FBI, has now said that it considers FaceApp the viral application that lets you view an older version of yourself as a potential counterintelligence threat. While the FBI was responding specifically to a U.S. lawmaker query about FaceApp, it actually said it considers all mobile applications developed in Russia to be risky business. This is because, as the FBI stated to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Moscow has a unique ability to access communications directly via ISPs, and it should be noted, though, that there is currently no evidence that FaceApp provided user data to Russian authorities. Everyone is listening to us. 2019 marked an insane year for a many, many reasons, but where privacy is concerned, one trend that we saw was related to basically every tech company with voice assistant products actively listening to user conversations. One of the first off the rank here was Amazon, which was employing thousands of third-party contractors to listen to queries. Asked of its Alexa voice assistant in an effort to clean up and refine the accuracy of its answers. The development was made more concerning by the fact that audio clips sometimes revealed possible criminal activity, including a potential sexual assault. As it turns out, though, Alexa wasn't alone in this practice. In fact, Facebook, Microsoft, Apple, and Google had all employed contractors to do the same thing. And in all these cases, the clips were anonymized with no possible way for contactors to identify the people they were listening to. Although, attaining permission to listen to conversations can be sketchy and users don't always know that it is occurring, making it just plain creepy. From Benjamin Rockwell, IT Pro Series, and he will present Windows 7 End of Life, Part 1. Part 2 will be next week.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and it's time for business. This is where I give you tidbits from my current and past experience of being a 30-year IT professional. Now, this week, we're going to be talking about the demise of Windows 7. Everybody's been told, all of the businesses have been told, you've got to be on Windows 10 by January 2020. They've known this for a number of years. They have known and they have prepared and everything is going wonderful and everybody is going to be converted by the deadline. Actually, I'm sorry. No, that's not true. There are a lot of companies, a ton of individuals, a ton of people out there that have not converted over to Windows 10. Windows 10 is, I'm going to tell you right off, Windows 10 is wonderful. It's great. It's nothing to fear. If you are not on Windows 10, Windows 10 is as reliable as Windows XP and Windows 7, depending on which one you figure is the more reliable. It's a good system. Now, everybody's afraid of this. And this is a past... it's not a past issue. It's a current issue. We have seen this for years. What do I mean by that? Well, okay, so every time we go to a new operating system, businesses and people, individuals, they sit back and they say, why do I need to upgrade? I'm not going to address that today. I'm not going to even touch on that topic. If you don't know why you should upgrade, that's a story for another day. What I'm going to talk about today is, should you be scared? Should you be concerned about the idea of your company not going to Windows 10? Well, to some extent, there are some concerns we should be aware of, and that is that security relies upon us running the latest operating system with the latest security patches, okay? But if they don't update, if they don't tackle the migration from Windows 7 to Windows 10 right away, it's okay. For one simple reason, a lot of the different malware authors have moved away from targeting older operating systems. They know that there is a deadline for them and that people are migrating away from previous versions of Windows to modern versions of Windows. We've seen this in the past where they've targeted newer operating systems far more rapidly, especially as the old systems die off. Now, are they also targeting what we call zero-day vulnerabilities on Windows 10 and Windows 7, where it crosses over and it's a vulnerability in both areas? Oh, yes, because they then get to hit more people with the problems at once. Okay, but that's the malware side of it. That's the security side of it. The reality is the reliability of Windows 7 is pretty close to the reliability of Windows 10, as well as Windows XP. They're all very reliable systems. There are going to be upcoming issues as different software packages no longer support, yes, Windows 7. And we've seen this in the past with Windows XP. One famous software out there that was web-based. I remember we were dealing with this at one company that I was called in to consult with. They said, hey, we're having a problem with this particular software. And I went and I said, you are aware that you're running Windows XP and Windows 7 is out, right? Yeah, we don't want to update. Well, okay, but that's the problem. You're running this older version of Internet Explorer. In this older version of Internet Explorer, you can update with Windows XP up to this level, but you can't go any further. That's why it's broken. I didn't even charge them for that. That was, they brought me in and it took me 10 minutes to figure out the problem. Of course, I've done other business with them and done other work. I was like, yeah, this is nothing. You guys just need to upgrade. And this is going to be a recurring issue every time we run into one of these end-of-life issues. Now, What you aren't aware of, probably, is the fact that the military, the United States military, still has systems that are running Windows XP. Now, they do pay millions of dollars to Microsoft to patch a lot of these different problems that they may have, and it's usually security problems. And the Royal Navy, yes, we're talking to the British Royal Navy, they also are running Windows ME. Yes, that's right, Windows ME. That's been dead for, I don't know, since the mid-2000s. And it's just cheaper for them to continue on than to upgrade. Why is that? Because of the volume of money that's required to go on through and upgrade these systems. Because you also have to go back. You have to find out what is broken. What is not going to work? What is going to jeopardize our security, our nation's security, if you do go through and you do upgrade? Now, that whole idea of QA, quality assurance, of testing, of making sure everything is running, that's something we're going to cover on another week in the near future. But for the most part, I want you to just relax because... yeah, your IT folks do have it handled. They will tackle it. They will address all of the issues, and they will protect you and the IT resources. Of course, if they don't, that could be their job that's on the line, not yours. So don't sweat it. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Are multiple core processors always better? When single-core CPU specifications were published, it was safe to say the relative megahertz rating was a good indication of CPU speed. But with multi-core processors, it's just one factor in determining computer speed. I use Passmark CPU benchmarks to determine relative CPU processor speed as a way of determining relative performance comparing one CPU to another. If a CPU with a higher multi-core processor count compares equivalent to a CPU with a lower core count but with a faster megahertz clock rating, which is better? The single-thread CPU rating is important in that it is the top speed of a single core, and this is given to you in the Passmark ratings. Core count is just one consideration for an efficient computer. Adding several cores to a single processor offers significant benefits thanks to the multitasking nature of modern operating systems. However, for some purposes, there's an upper practical limit to how many cores yield improvements relative to the cost of adding them. Multi-core processors have been available in personal computers since the late 1990s. Multi-core designs address the problem of processors hitting the ceiling of their physical limitations in terms of their clock speeds and how effectively they could be cooled and still maintain accuracy. By moving to extra cores on a single processing chip, manufacturers avoided problems with the clock speeds by effectively multiplying the amount of data that can be handled by the CPU. When they originally were released, manufacturers offered just two cores in a single CPU, but now there are options for 4, 6, and even 10 or more. In addition to adding cores, Intel's hyper-threading technology doubles the virtual cores that the operating system sees. A process is a specific task, like a program running on a computer. A process consists of one or more threads. A thread is simply a single stream of data from a program passing through the processor on the computer. Each application generates its own one or more threads depending upon how it is running. With multitasking, a single-core processor can only handle a single thread at a time, so the system rapidly switches between the threads to process the data in a seemingly concurrent manner. The benefit of having multiple cores is that the system can handle more than one thread simultaneously. Each core can handle a separate stream of data. This architecture greatly increases the performance of a system that is running concurrent applications. Since servers tend to run many concurrent applications at a given time, the technology was originally developed for the enterprise customer. But as the personal computers got more complex and multitasking increased, They too benefited from having extra cores. Every process, however, is governed by a primary thread that can only occupy a single core. Thus, the relative speed of a program like a game or a video renderer is hard limited to the capability of the core that the primary thread consumes. The primary thread can absolutely delegate secondary threads to other cores, but a game doesn't become twice as fast when you double the cores. Thus, it is not unusual for a game to fully max one core, but see only partial utilization of other cores for secondary threads. No amount of core doubling gets around the fact that the primary core is a rate limiter for your application, and apps that are sensitive to this architecture will perform better than apps that aren't. While the concept of multiple core processors sounds appealing, there is a major caveat to this technology. For the true benefits of the multiple processors to be enjoyed, the software running on the computer must be written to support multi-threading, and without the software supporting such a feature, threads will be primarily run through a single core, thus degrading the computer's overall efficiency. After all, if it can only run on a single core in a quad-core processor, it may actually be faster to run it on a dual-core processor with a higher base clock speed. All of the major current operating systems support multi-threading capability, but the multi-threading must also be written into the application software. The support for multi-threading in consumer software has improved over the years, but for many simple programs, multi-threading support is still not implemented due to the complexity of the software build. For example, a mail program or web browser is not likely to see huge benefits to multi-threading as much as a graphics or video editing program would, where the computer processes complex calculations. A good example to explain this tendency is to look at a typical computer game. Most games require some form of rendering engine to display what is happening in the game. In addition, some sort of artificial intelligence controls events and characters in the game. With a single core, both tasks execute by switching between them. This approach is not efficient. Going beyond two cores presents mixed benefits, given that the answer for any given computer buy depends upon the software he or she typically uses. For example, many classic games still offer little performance difference between two and four cores. Even modern games, some of which allegedly require or support eight cores, may not perform better than a six-core machine with a higher base clock speed, given that the effectiveness of the primary thread governs the efficiency of multi-threaded performance. On the other hand, a video encoding program that transcodes video would likely see huge benefits as individual frame rendering can be passed to different cores and then collated into a single stream by the software. Thus, having eight cores will be even more beneficial than having four. In essence, the primary thread doesn't need comparatively rich resources. Instead, it can farm out the hard work to daughter threads that max out the processor's cores. The higher the clock speed, the faster the processor. Clock speeds become more nebulous when you consider speeds relative to multiple cores because processors crunch multiple data threads thanks to the extra cores, but each of those cores will be running at lower speeds because of the thermal restrictions. For example, a dual-core processor may support base clock speed of 3.5 GHz for each processor, while a quad-core processor may only run at 3 GHz. Just looking at a single core of each of them, the dual-core processor is 14% faster than on the quad-core. So thus, if you have a program that is only single-threaded, the dual-core processor is actually more efficient. Then again, if your software can use all four processors, then the quad-core processor will actually be about 70% faster than the dual-core processor. Net-net, in conclusions, for the most part, a dual-core or quad-core processor will be more than enough power for a basic computer user. The majority of consumers will see no tangible benefits from going beyond four processor cores because so little non-specialized software takes advantage of it. The best use case for high core count processors relates to machines that perform complex tasks such as desktop video editing, some form of high-end gaming, or complicated science and math programs. If you have video or audio editing, you could probably take advantage of more than four cores at one time. Hey, Marty, there's a CES show. What are we going to get?
CES, and from where most people sit, it seems to be the technology version of a candy store. Well, let me disavow you of that belief. Most of what's there this year, first of all, isn't so very different from what was there the year before or the year before that. Most of the stuff that looks really amazing, that looks like the future, may come when it is the future, but isn't coming anytime all that soon right now. What you're seeing are prototypes or demos. They're the tech trade show version of a Hollywood publicity stunt. Sometimes they get built to draw press people into covering the gizmo, sometimes to draw dealers into signing up for it. But there's a lot of veterans in both camps that have learned to take a wait-and-see attitude. Did you buy a 3D TV set? How many hours a week is there anything on TV for you to watch in 3D? Most people never bought a 3D TV, and for those of you who did not, do you know anybody, anyone at all, who owns one? And that's out of a total of how many people you know overall? It never became the fad that they wanted to push on us. There is no end of hype at CES. Oh, how about a curved screen TV? Did you buy one of those? Did you notice how much harder it was, maybe impossible, to put it somewhere in the room where it wasn't always reflecting a window or a light every second, all the time? Curved, concave reflectors are good at that. And if you look at it, that's one way to just regard what the set ends up being. But still, the glamour, the pizzazz, the tech, the gizmos. From afar, CES sounds glamorous, but here's what it's really like for those people who have really, actually been there. First up, your feet. If you're working a booth, you're standing all day for 4 days or more, and nothing in the floor or on the way your shoes are made can possibly stop your feet from hurting. And if you're not in a booth, you're walking the aisles and often walking between hotels and exhibit halls. A taxi line can mean a 90-minute wait, and the taxi alternatives are no better. Count on dropping $20, even if you're only heading for mid-strip from the convention center. You'll also probably drop $20 at breakfast, $20 at lunch, and $40 to $75 at supper, plus another $40 at the bar. The plates are bigger than what you're used to, some the size of serving plates, and they're full, edge to edge. Most plates can feed two or three or four people at normal portion sizes. But it's not like it will be any good to eat if you try to take a doggy bag back to the room. Where will you keep it? Any disruption to whatever's in the mini fridge can cost hundreds of dollars on your bill, which itself might be $100 a night in a junky and inconvenient place to $600 or $700 a night in places that are slightly more convenient. Okay, so far your feet will hurt, your belly will hurt, and your bank balance will hurt. Shall we continue? Have you ever been to Las Vegas? How's your sense of geography? In case you didn't notice, it's in the middle of a desert. It's dry. It's almost impossible to drink enough water while you're there, and drinking booze makes that even worse. You'll also be dog tired. On a relaxed day, I don't have to get up at 4 a.m. I can sleep until 6 or 6:30. On a busy night, I might not be able to get to bed by 1 a.m., maybe not until 3 or 3:30. By the way, when you chase down recreation at night, remember, what happens in Vegas only stays in Vegas if you make bail. Okay, I know you're pure and innocent and don't have to worry about that. Let's go to another factor that you probably never think about until it happens to you. Start with this. You had to prep and pack and get to a hotel and check in and head off for whatever's next. The exhibits at CES are only open for 4 days, but there are 2 days before that when other things are happening. So you're arriving from an airport to spend as many as 6 days and nights with very little sleep, bad eating choices, foot and muscle fatigue, some level of dehydration, and not your best ever physical condition. And you've made it through a busy airport, or two or three. just to be surrounded by something between 150,000 and 200,000 strangers. Any chance you might catch a cold, or worse? That's the glamour. That's the pizzazz. That's the magic. Do you still think you want to go to CES? You could just stay home and catch the coverage. Or even better, keep an eye on your favorite stores to see if any of those oh-so-stunning and inventive new products ever really get built for people to buy. In a way, actually going to CES is a lot like playing strip solitaire. Even if you win, you don't.
Thank you, Marty. From Mark Leosa, Battery Care According to the Battery University.
Did you get a new phone or tablet this holiday season? I'm Mark Leosa with a quick reminder for giving your lithium-ion batteries a long life. According to the Battery University, yes, there's one, they recommend your device be charged between 30 and 80%, a range that keeps battery cells from overcharging. Batteries are like people. They don't like to be too hot or too cold and function well between 25 and 100 degrees Fahrenheit. If it's over 100 degrees, keep your device in the shade and close unnecessary apps. If it's below 25 degrees, keep your device warm, an inside pocket will do. And what if your battery dies? Official equipment manufacturers prefer you buy their expensive batteries for the certainty of performance. There are approved aftermarket batteries that cost less and have the same level of performance. Then there are counterfeit batteries with markings that look official but aren't giving you reliable energy and may have a short battery life. Have you ever used a charger not made for your device? You might get a slow charge message. Mismatched chargers and cables can damage your device. Your device might have an internal battery protection circuit that ends the charge. Otherwise, your phone can be damaged, or possibly an explosion or fire, like what happened with the official battery and device, the Samsung Galaxy Note 7S. Use the proper cable and charger for the longest battery life and the safety of your device. Here's a travel tip. When you're in an area that has an unstable energy source, charge your battery pack and then your phone or device. Charge your battery pack and then your phone or device, avoiding power surges that could damage your phone or tablet. Wishing you and your battery lots of energy in the new year. I'm Mark Leosa.
Thank you, Mark. And for Marty Winston, all hands on tech and retrofitting a 40-year house to be energy efficient.
Well, happy new year. And I also want to say happy new decade. I don't want to hear anything about not having a year zero. Let's just go with the even number, with the 2020, and call it a new decade. By the way, you know, 20% of the new century, 2% of the new millennium are already behind us. That leaves 80% of a century and 98% of a millennium that we can still forecast. And the odds are that none of us will be around when either one is over. Heck, I may not make it until then myself. So there's no point in disagreeing with me over what I see coming. And it's a leap year, which makes some of us chant, 4 more years, and others chant, not one more day. But let's not leap into those discussions. I'll stick with products. That's my wheelhouse anyway, and share what I think we'll all see before too very long. I think that if this show had, 750 million listeners, and each one of you were to buy a lottery ticket and send it to me, there might be, maybe 1,000-to-1 chance that I could claim enough money to pay for everything I want to do to make my house be everything it can be. And that's not because it's a big house. We moved into this 40-year-old house last April, and I am intent on retrofitting it with what it needs to have to be a lot more energy efficient and involve a lot fewer chores. Good luck, right? I'm taking my time evaluating the things that need to happen and working through what that takes. Books and folders of drawings and plans and materials lists, mountains of tools I haven't owned before, and some materials I hadn't known about before. My basement is the epicenter for all of this, and I have bigger changes ahead than just the bunch I want to go into here. But I'm starting with the things that, well, things that a lot of older houses have in common, and some things we face that are quite uncommon. The basement itself is unusual. When we moved in, this, remember, 1979 built, 40-year house. When we moved in, the only walls other than the cinder block walls were the ones surrounding the stairs to the kitchen. The floor is concrete and nicely flat. I think there was a total of, maybe 4 to 5 electrical outlets in the whole place. The ceiling is exposed rafters, and the rafters are where the round metal ventilation ducts run and the metal water pipes and the gas pipe and some power wires. There used to be an oil heater, so there's a cinder block chimney shaft that extends from the middle of the basement up through the middle of the kitchen and right next to a toilet in one of the upstairs bathrooms, and then out through the roof. The house is on septic and tested positive for radon. So we had to have its sump wells covered and sealed and an exhaust fan installed in the far corner. Standard stuff, right? It's a big basement, roughly 30 by 50, 1,500 square feet, but only about 7 feet tall. I needed to tame it. So we did some initial framing to establish surrounding walls and interior spaces. There's one large space that has my office at one end and a multi-purpose TV studio is the bulk of the area at the other end. There's a smaller space behind that with a test bench, part storage, and its own quite small TV studio area. There's a walled-off area behind the stairs for the utilities, you know, elements of the heat, water, air conditioning system, and a corner in there for my rack systems. In other words, everything that makes noise. The last slice of the basement, farthest from where my office is mostly for storage. We installed some shelving, we'll be adding more, and we're adding 2 side-by-side closet size areas, one for a cedar closet and one to house, utility stuff, the electrical center, the radon pump, communication signal amplifiers, that kind of thing. As much as possible, I've been tearing out the old analog telephone cabling. We've been running other wires. I should mention that we upgraded from a 24-position breaker box to a 60-position breaker. Electrical load distribution center. And added whole house surge protection. All the new wiring, and a lot of the old, is 12-gauge, rated to carry 20 amps, but mostly connecting to 15-amp sockets. So we're pretty far down the road of adding a ton of new outlets, cable TV coax, and that's for our TiVo nodes, wired Ethernet, and that kind of thing. As far as we are with the power wiring, we've really not even started yet on wiring in the switches and junction boxes for the lighting, almost entirely LED fixture lighting. That will happen, but there are other things we're also trying to accomplish up in the rafters. I'm talking about the basement ceiling rafters now, and here's where we get into some interesting materials. Take those round metal ventilation ducts, for example. Whether the air blowing inside them is hotter or colder than the overall basement, that airflow is going to change the temperature of the metal, and the metal will change the temperature of the air in the basement. Yeah, metal's a good conductor of heat, and if it weren't, would you use metal pots and pans on the stove? Really, metal can do that. In other words, we're going to take those ducts and make them lose some of the ability of the ducted air to heat or cool the house, except at the vent registers. The best way to stop that loss is to replace the metal ducts with flexible, round, double-wall insulated ducts. The insulation stops most of the energy loss, and the construction of those flexible ducts also greatly reduces the amount of air noise that can come through their walls. The trade-off is a few hundred dollars total to buy them, plus the time spent to get the old ducts out and the new ducts in and sealed at their joints, and a little work making sure they don't droop and they stay up above the bottom line of the rafter boards. The same kind of thing happens with the water pipes, losing some of the hotness of the hot water and some of the coolness of the cold water with every foot they run. We could solve that somewhat just by adding relatively inexpensive insulation around the metal pipes, and there's nothing to recommend against that for you. We want to replace the metal pipes with flexible PEX piping, which is part of a bigger project. Remember the song, Them Dry Bones? The PEX lines all get run to a manifold. You know, the foot bone's connected to the nose bone or something. The PEX lines all get run to a manifold, and that's like a big switch box which has a separate attachment for each hot line and each cold line, each with its own little shutoff valve. The house is on a well, and we can split indoor water, which we want to use for cooking and cleaning, from outdoor water, which is a lot more about washing and cars and watering the greens. The outdoor water can connect directly to what the pump puts out. The indoor water will take whatever conditioning we want to put it through. And some of that indoor water goes to the hot water system. The manifold is kind of our controllable junction block for a lot of that. It's even more complicated because we plan to replace our indoor hot water heater. It's the old-fashioned kind with a tank, and an outdoor-mounted tankless water heater, we have it in the box ready to go, needs to be mounted and integrated. These things won't be a do-it-yourself project for me. It's plumber time. I won't even get into how much the sources of cooled and heated air will change, but some of it involves adding a whole house electrostatic air cleaner, a whole house humidifier, and some other goodies. Are you wondering about dehumidifiers? The house has two attics, and I have two dehumidifiers, one good for 70 pints per day and the other for 90. Both are Honeywell. Both are attic items, and I want to stick with the basement for now, for tonight. Merry Christmas, right? In my basement. Once all the wires and all the new flexible insulated ducts and all the new insulated PEX gets run, I'll be mounting the ceiling itself, and that might not be what you expect. Remember, I only have a 7-foot tall space to work with, so I'm not fond of the idea of a drop ceiling taking 3 to 4 inches away from that. And anyway, hanging all those frames is expensive and tedious, and acoustic ceiling tiles tend to discolor and crack over time. I found something better, only 1 inch thick, flexible, not rigid, lightweight, really effective at reducing noise, and highly resistant to water or mold. It's made by Fabri-Trac. It's called Autem, A-U-T-E-M, Autem. Normally, it's the kind of thing you can just glue to the bottoms of the rafters, but I don't want to do that. That would make it hard to take those things out, take that ceiling down, if I have to do something with the ducts or pipes or wires up there. So, did you hear me mention they're lightweight? Here's what I figured out. Magnets. I found some small super magnets on Amazon with holes in the middle and a taper that can hold a flathead screw flush. I can easily screw those into the rafters. Then I got some big steel fender washers, cheap, and I can use a construction adhesive to glue them onto the back of the tile where they'll line up with the magnets. A 2-foot by 2-foot Autem panel weighs about 2 pounds. Each magnet can hold 5 pounds at 4 per sheet. I'll be solid. The walls will get the usual drywall on them, but only after they get foam blown in to fill between the studs, more insulation. And the order doesn't matter as much because, of course, I can pull down the magnet mount ceiling panels when I paint the drywall and put them back when the paint's dry. The flooring will be a luxury vinyl tile, LVT, which I can click into place and cut at the far edges. Then a trim at the bottom of the wall will button up the overall finish of the space. So what's the difference between what I'm doing and what you would do? Well, you could have just called in a contractor and not made as many decisions about things, or you could, and I think this is what most people are doing, go to a place like Lowe's or Home Depot and choose among what they have. For me, there's been a huge amount of homework. I've been to trade shows, spoken with vendors, grilled tech support, burrowed through web searches, pulled in scores of sample materials to test, and probably became utterly annoying. That's my job. I am a professional smart aleck know-it-all.
Thank you, Marty.
Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. there is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public.
The Westchester PC Users Group has a meeting January the 2nd, 7 p.m., and the topic of presentation is the Codebreakers. They'll meet at the Keller Williams New York Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, Friday, January 3rd, 2020, at 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Long Island Macintosh User Group will meet Thursday, January the 9th, 2020, at 7 p.m., Old Westbury Campus, New York Tech, and they'll meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a meeting on Thursday, January the 9th, 2020, at 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building. Check at the front desk for the room number. Brookdale Computer Users Group, they meet Thursday, January 23rd, 2020, at 6:45 p.m. in the large meeting room of the Middletown Library at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey.
We hope to see you at one of these meetings, and if you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org.
Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, Benjamin Rockwell, and Mark Leosa, we wish all a happy and healthy new year. We thank you for your listening support. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station.